Where you walk, do you want to lose mine? Hey, you walk right in, step right down, and down in your mind, roll on.
You've been listening to NGLTF Executive Director Matt Foreman moderating a panel of participants in 1977's first ever meeting at the White House with LGBT activists. You heard comments edited by This White House's Lucia Chappell, by former Carter White House advisor Midge Costanza and her former assistant Marilyn Haft, former U.S. Congressperson Elaine Noble, the Reverend Troy Perry, and activists Frank Kameny, George Rea, Charlotte Bunch, and Pokey Anderson. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Charles Hall, Rick Watts, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Graham Underhill, and Lucia Chappell contributed program material. Gus Cannon's Jug Stompers performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. You can listen online to This Way Out anytime, exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can get there by clicking on the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from listeners like you. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of our weekly programs there. To sign up for our weekly email program information messages and or our occasional This Way Out updates, to request a copy of this week's program, or with any other questions, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on CKLU, Sudbury, Ontario, WBCR, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, KOPN, Columbia, Missouri, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. Please stay tuned next for Counterpoint, and you can hear the preceding program This Way Out every Monday evening between 7:30 and 8 p.m. right here. So stay with us. We'll be back in with Counterpoint in just a moment.
Hey, Bill Nolan, what's happening?
Well, Dave, we're going to have a very exciting summer with some tremendous live blues bands coming in here. On June 17th, it'll be Paul Gabriel and his band that'll be performing. On July 1st, Gary and the Mood Swingers. July 15th, the Mojomatics, and Paul Gabriel will be returning with that band. August 5th, Fade to Blues. August 12th, the Cobalt Rhythm Kings. September 9th will be Spyros Soukas. And September 16th will be Chaz DiPaolo. And that'll be the live blues activity we'll be having every Sunday evening at 7:30 p.m. It's going to be free, you know, open to the public. Listeners could come in and watch these tremendous performers for free. Live radio every Sunday at 7:30.
And it's a great series. Come on down and avail yourself of these free concerts here at the station Sunday evening, 7:30 p.m. Oh, right across the summer into September. And you can call 203-331-9756 for more information about those concerts. And right now we're going to go to Counterpoint, so do stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment.
Fury's breathing down.
Good evening and welcome to Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris here Mondays between 8 and 10 p.m. We're glad you could join us. And we've got, I think what we have, an interesting show for you this evening. We've got a number of guests covering a wide swath of ground. And in just a minute, we're going to be talking about some interesting cases and important cases regarding civil liberties, habeas corpus, and the violation of rights during the course of the Bush presidency. We'll be speaking with attorney Aziz Huq in just a few minutes. Paul Waldman of the group Media Matters for America will be summarizing a report issued by his organization that challenges the myth that America is politically ever more conservative. Moira Mack of a campaign called Iraq Summer will describe an effort to hold Republican members of Congress accountable for their support of President Bush's Iraq war policies. And lastly, tonight we'll hear from Leslie Angeline of Code Pink, and she's going to be talking about the actions that she's participated in targeting U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman from here in Connecticut, as he's called in the press several times in the last week for military action against the nation of Iran, what many people are feeling is quite reckless behavior on his part as a U.S. Senator. So we'll be hearing from those voices this evening. We hope you'll stick around. And right now I want to introduce Aziz Huq. He is the director of the Liberty and Security Project at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. Aziz is also co-author of the recently published book titled Unchecked and Unbalanced. Aziz, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show, Scott.
Glad you could be here. And we are going to concentrate on a couple of cases that your organization, the Brennan Center, is working with. And I thought, although I know you're not working directly on this case, I thought we could talk initially about the case of Ali Salakala Mari. My pronunciation is way off there, but you can correct me on that.
No.
He's a legal resident of the U.S., and just last week, a federal appeals court ruled that the U.S. government could not detain this individual indefinitely without charge, per the kind of architecture that the Bush administration has set up. So maybe you can give us some comment on the import of this case.
Well, Scott, this case is really about how and when the president, acting outside the ordinary framework of courts and the criminal law, can seize somebody and detain them, claiming that they are somehow connected to terrorism. And what the administration was arguing in the Almari case was that it had the power, either under the Constitution or under a statute that was passed in September 2001, to pick up anyone, a citizen or a non-citizen, designate them as what it called an enemy combatant, and keep them locked up in a military brig for an indefinite period of time. And what happened last week was that the appeals court in Richmond, Virginia, the Fourth Circuit, rejected that claim by the administration. The appeals court held that neither the Constitution nor the federal statute that authorized the war in Iraq, it's called the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, neither of these things allow the president, give the president power to simply designate individuals as enemy combatants and then have them locked up. And this is tremendously important because people's freedom from arbitrary detention, people's freedom from being locked up for reasons that they don't understand or may not know, depends on how you get locked up, what process, what due process you get. Do you get the full panoply of rights that a criminal trial gives, or do you get a chance to state your case to a military officer before the door closes behind you?
Now, tell us a little bit about the circumstances under which Almari was arrested and imprisoned in a military brig in South Carolina and designated finally as an enemy combatant.
Well, the circumstances are quite telling. What happened was that Mr. Almari came into the United States in September 2001 to study at a university in Illinois. He was arrested in December of 2001 and charged with a variety of federal crimes. His case went through the federal criminal justice system, which is slow, as in many cases it's slow, until in mid-2003, he was on the verge of his trial beginning. Literally, military officers turned up in the courtroom in New York and said, "Oh, we have a slip of paper saying that Mr. Almari, who at this time was in jail, remember, he's in jail, is such a danger to the United States that we are going to, that the president has decided that he must be detained as an enemy combatant from now on. And in fact, from that point, for about 16 months, Mr. Al-Mari was denied access to anyone, either his family, friends, or even legal representation. He had no access to the outside world. And since that time in 2003, he's been held in a military brig in South Carolina.
Do we know what the government is alleging and the reasons behind his designation as an enemy combatant?
Well, the government alleges a number of very serious criminal offenses. We believe, as Al-Mari's lawyers, that if the government thinks that somebody's done something criminal, what they should do is charge that person in a federal court, as indeed they were in the process of doing in Al-Mari's case. There is some evidence from, for example, John Ashcroft's autobiography, which recently came out, which suggests that the reason that they decided to designate Mr. Al-Mari is that he was not being as forthcoming in terms of cooperation as they wanted him to be. So many people, when they're faced with the prospect of a long prison sentence, will cooperate with the prosecutor and will offer information in exchange for a lenient sentence. And Al-Mari was not playing that game, as is his right to do so under the Constitution. He has a right to go to trial. And so the administration played hardball.
Now, as a legal resident, does he lack any of the constitutional guarantees that any ordinary citizen does? And I say that thinking there probably are some limitations on their rights. But how does it affect this case in terms of his legal residency versus a citizen?
Well, he's not actually a legal resident, which is somebody who has a green card. He was here on a student visa. So there's a little difference there. But it's not a difference with much significance here. If you are a person and you're inside the United States, then there are certain kinds of rights that attach regardless of whether you're a citizen or non-citizen or what sort of immigration status you have. And among those rights are the rights to due process, the right to free speech, the right to equality of treatment regardless of race or religion. All of those things, which are some of the things that are at issue in the Al-Mari case, benefit citizens and non-citizens in the United States without any distinction. There are other rights that citizens have, for example, the rights that pertain to voting that non-citizens don't have. Non-citizens can also be deported, and obviously citizens can't be deported. So there are some differences, but they're not relevant in this particular case.
Now, what's the import of the federal court's ruling here? How will the federal court's ruling affect U.S. policy in Guantanamo, the secret prisons that are alleged to exist across Europe and the Mediterranean? What on the ground, what will happen as a result of this case, or is this bound to go up the line to eventually the Supreme Court if it gets that far?
I think it's pretty likely that it will go up the line. And the most relevant part of the case is the court's definition of who can lawfully be detained under the statutes and the Constitution. And what it said is that Congress has granted the power to detain people who are quote unquote combatant. And the court went into a fairly elaborate discussion of who qualifies as a combatant under very established rules for warfare, the international law of war, it's called. And so that part of the decision is extraordinarily relevant. The other thing that it said that is relevant, and that's going to be relevant to all of the things that you talked about, to Guantanamo, it's going to be relevant to the black site. The other thing that's relevant in the decision is its discussion of a statute called the Military Commissions Act, which was passed last year, and that tried to take away the federal court jurisdiction over habeas corpus petitions. And what the Fourth Circuit said is, well, whatever that meant, it didn't apply in the United States. It didn't apply to even non-citizens in the United States, and that's very important too, although it won't directly affect it won't even indirectly affect either the Guantanamo cases or the extraordinary rendition circumstances. And we know, by the way, that the CIA and perhaps the military is still involved in extraordinary rendition and the use of covert prisons, because there's a continual flow up until a week and a half ago of people to Guantanamo from such sites.
We're speaking with Aziz Huq. He's the director of Liberty and Security Project at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University, and he's co-author of the book titled Unchecked and Unbalanced. Aziz, tell us about another case that you've been working on, and that is the case of Mohammed Mounaf, a U.S. citizen being held in Iraq and facing execution there.
That's right. There's actually two cases involving U.S. citizens who are detained in Iraq. One is the case of Mr. Mounaf, and the other is a case involving a gentleman called Shawki Omar. Both of them are U.S. citizens. Both of them are held by U.S. forces in Iraq, and we, through their families, represent both of them. And the question in these cases is, if you're somebody who's a citizen of the United States and you're swept up in the course of war by your own government, what rights do you have? Do you have the right to come into a court and say, you have the wrong person? You need to give me a chance to show that I'm not the bad guy that you think I am. And back in 2004, the Supreme Court said that citizens have that right. And that was a case called Hamdi. Now, in these cases, the government has come in and said, no, you don't have that right, even if you're a citizen, provided that we can say that the military operation is a multinational one, provided that we can say that there is a UN label on the door, there is no federal court jurisdiction to examine these cases. And what's happened in those cases is that in one case, in Omar, the court of appeals rejected that argument. And in the other case, the Mounaf case, which you mentioned, the court accepted it. And what the court said is that there's a difference in a case in which somebody has been criminally convicted in a foreign court. Now, to be quite frank, we think that that's nonsense. We think that why should that make a difference to the power of a federal court? There's nothing to do with what the federal courts are going to do. And so what we're in the process of asking the Supreme Court to review that judgment in Mounaf.
What's at stake here in terms of the rights of U.S. citizens who are being held abroad, if not in Iraq, in another country at another time in the future?
Well, there's a lot at stake, because this is an argument. This argument that if you attach a label to something and call it multinational, and you secure the collaboration of another country that you can funnel people to, you know, with the guise of a conviction, you escape the review of a federal court. And we already know that the American government collaborates with many other foreign governments which are less than savory and are less than compliant with international human rights norms, countries such as Egypt, countries such as Syria, countries such as Jordan. And you know, this case has come up in the unusual context of Iraq, and it happens to be a citizen who's involved here. But the broader significance of these cases is under what circumstances can the United States simply transfer people to other governments where it ought to know that torture or worse will follow. So what's at stake here is at least one aspect of this global detention system that has been established in the last 4 or 5 years.
Just to be clear, and I know you said this, but this individual, or there are two individuals we're talking about, Mr. Mounaf and Mr. Omar, were both held by U.S. forces and turned over to the Iraqi government?
They have been held since 2004 and 2005, respectively, by the U.S. government. What the U.S. government wants to do is to say, federal courts, you have no role here. We will just hand these people over to the Iraqi government. Now, both Mr. Omar and Mr. Mounaf are Sunni, which is one of the two branches of Islam. And we know, as a matter of fact, through reporting from Iraq, that if you are Sunni and you fall into the hands of the Shia government in Iraq, well, you're in big trouble. And we know also that Mr. Mounaf has been sentenced to death already. in a trial that barely lasted a day. So there are. This is a case in which neither of our clients have been handed over, but there are serious consequences, very, very serious consequences of the highest order that would follow if they were handed over.
So they're being held still, and depending on what the courts say, and you're trying to get the Supreme Court to review this case, at least with Mr. Munaf, to determine what their status will eventually be.
Right. The issue right now is, do the federal courts have power to hear these cases, or can the government, by labeling something as foreign, can it escape review when it detains a U.S. citizen? And that's really... That's very dangerous. If you create an exception, if you create a black hole to review, you're asking for trouble, because we've seen what this administration does with black holes, legal black holes.
And just to take a step back, you want to give us some details on what Mr. Omar and Mr. Munaf are alleged to have done? As you said, Mr. Munaf now facing the death penalty in Iraq. What are the allegations against these two people?
Sure. Again, they're very serious allegations. Mr. Omar is accused of having links to the insurgency, although the links are rather ill-described in the filings that the government has made. It's not terribly clear what he actually did or what the government thinks he did. And Mr. Munaf has been convicted in relation to a kidnapping, and a kidnapping that was for pecuniary gain, that was for money. Which has nothing to do with terrorism or anything like that. They simply say that we can hold this person and hand him over. And as a matter of principle, we're not going to let you look at this case, federal courts.
So, again, it's a situation where we're not talking about the relative guilt or innocence of these individuals. It's really the judicial process in the review, the legal review, that's been missing, especially with regard to the Bush administration's policies about determination of people's guilt or innocence.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right, Scott. What's at issue here is not, can you lock up somebody who's guilty of a crime? The question is, can the government get the benefit of locking somebody up? And the government does benefit in terms of, it gets sort of a reputational kudos. It gets to announce it in the press. It gets to sort of say, yes, we're tough on crime, tough on terrorism, what have you. Can it get all of those benefits without jumping through the hoops that the Constitution sets up when you lock somebody up? And so it's really an argument about, if you're going to use this most awesome of powers that you have, the power to lock people up, power to take away their physical liberty, do you have to dot your I's and cross your T's? And the government's position, and this has actually been true since late 2001, the government's position is no, we don't have to do that. We can lock people up without going through any meaningful process. We don't need to justify ourselves when we lock people up. And it's used a variety of arguments to justify this, and Guantanamo was the first variant on that position. This made-up term, unlawful enemy combatants, is another example of that. And then this argument about multinational forces is yet another way of evading judicial review.
We're speaking tonight with Aziz Haque. He is the director of the Liberty and Security Project at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University, and he's the co-author of the book titled Unchecked and Unbalanced. And Aziz, I wanted to ask you about the Supreme Court. Bringing these cases to the Supreme Court certainly has some danger in that the makeup of the court is such that they seem to favor, at least in some initial cases with the new Chief Justice, they seem to sort of be bending over backwards in favor of ripping up the Constitution in some instances when the justification is to protect the nation from terrorism.
Well, the Supreme Court so far has been reasonably good, I think, on terrorism issues, and we had favorable judgments from the civil liberties side in the Hamdi case, in the Rasool case, which involved the Guantanamo detainees, and then in the Hamdan case in 2006, which involved the military commissions. And those were, in large part, narrow victories, but they were victories. It was very, very disappointing that the Supreme Court decided not to hear the Guantanamo detainees case in April this year. That was the Boumediene case that involved the position of the Guantanamo detainees and habeas after the habeas stripping had occurred. That was a big disappointment for many people, and that was suddenly the court not, I think, stepping in when it really could have done something very salutary. And there's certainly a lot to be concerned about on this issue, at least, in terms of the new appointees to the court. The new appointees are not people who are sympathetic to civil liberties claims, not just in the security context, but if you look at their criminal procedure decisions in the last couple of years, or if you look at their religious freedom, their First Amendment jurisprudence, you see people who are, you see justices who are reflexively or by nature deferential to the claims of authority for the exercise of power, the claims that we need this authority to be able to accomplish this important social goal, be that in schools, be that in the context of police actions and police arrests here in the United States, or be it in the national security context, that you have that same deference to the needs of an executive policymaker being shown across the board. And so you're absolutely right that in the future we need to be, we would not be wise to be overly optimistic about the role of the Supreme Court in being a vigorous advocate of civil liberties in the face of executive overreaching.
Yeah, no, I think with Chief Justice John Roberts there, and as you say, the balance kind of tipping since his nomination, and with two new Supreme Court justices there, really kind of changing the makeup of the court, it could go in a very different direction and set precedents that could last 40, 50 years into the future.
Well, I don't think that there's any question that for the next 10 years, you will have a functional majority of the Supreme Court that is extraordinarily conservative,
mm-hmm.
And that's, I think within a week or two we will see, particularly in the equal protection context, the first kind of big sea change on that.
And Aziz Hawk, I wanted to ask you about the role of Congress here. What can Congress do right now with the Democrats and the majority of the House and Senate? What can they do to restore some of the rights that have been lost through executive action on the part of the Bush administration when it comes to extraordinary rendition, the torture issues, the issues we're talking about in the cases that you're involved in regarding U.S. citizens or U.S. residents facing these kinds of unilateral decision-making without court review?
Right. I think that there's two things that Congress can do straight off the bat. The first is to restore habeas corpus. And that was something that was attacked in the 2005 Detainee Treatment Act and again in the 2006 Military Commissions Act. And there really is no excuse for failing to restore a part of American law that's been there since 1789. So that really should be top of the agenda. The second thing that Congress can do is to hold hearings. Now, this may sound banal, but Congress's power to investigate, to shed light on the facts behind detention operations, is a quantum leap greater than what the press can do. Congress simply has far more tools at its disposal. And Congress simply has not stepped up to the plate here. And, regardless of whether you are a Democrat or a Republican, regardless of whether you are a hawk or a dove on security, it makes just no sense to allow our government to engage in detention operations which are counterproductive, which are largely ensnaring the wrong people, which are having a tremendous impact on the reputation of the United States around the world. We are, incidentally, at the moment, one of the three most feared nations in the world in terms of posing a threat to global peace, according to reliable international surveys. The United States cannot win a counterterrorism effort that is essentially a war of ideas with the detention practices that it presently has. And so, until Congress, by shedding light on what has happened through hearings, by clarifying the extent of mistakes, and I think we know a lot, but I think we would be Pollyanna-ish if we thought that we knew everything. I think very, very far from it. Congress can, by clarifying these things, can set the stage for a lot better and a lot more humane detention regime.
And one thing that we will not have time to talk about tonight is public opinion, and that is seems key, that there is so little attention paid in the news to these major issues of civil liberties and shredding of the Bill of Rights and, as you said, the kind of dissolution of habeas corpus after a couple of hundred years on the books. It seems that, you know, we're going quietly, like a frog slowly boiled in water, on our way to losing many cherished rights without so much as a whimper from, you know, the public at large.
The public occasionally makes itself known. The 2006 elections were not necessarily only about the Iraq War. I think that there was also a real sentiment that this is an administration that was out of keeping in its security practices with the American tradition of checks and balances. So, you know, I think that I'm not somebody who lacks faith in the American public or in the democratic processes. They don't work perfectly by any stretch of the imagination, but they work a lot better than things are in many other places.
Well, our next topic on this program is the media and the role of the media in getting us essential information so we can make decisions and act as citizens, and I think this topic fits right in there. A lot of people just don't have the basic facts.
I think that's right.
You know, they think everybody who's been detained or sent to Egypt for torture is guilty.
Well, even if you're guilty, you shouldn't be sent anywhere for torture.
But of course, that's the misinformation that's been part of the line in the media forever.
Absolutely.
Well, Aziz, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and leave our listeners with a way for them to get in touch with you, get more information about these specific cases and other works that you do there at the Brennan Center.
Well, we have a website, www.brennencenter.org. And on Checks on Balance, which really kind of reviews all of these policies, puts them in the historical perspective since World War II, is, I think, available in most bookstores and certainly on Amazon and the like.
Well, Aziz, thanks. It's been good of you to spend time with us tonight.
Thanks, Scott.
Best of luck with the cases.
Take care.
Bye-bye. That was Aziz Huq. He's a co-author of the book titled Unchecked and Unbalanced and director of the Liberty and Security Project at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. We're going to take a quick break and be back with a discussion of the media with Paul Waldman of the group Media Matters for America. Stay tuned.
The issue of immigration is ever more in the spotlight since the Immigration Reform Bill is debated in the Senate and the city of New Haven, Connecticut, recently voted 25-1 to approve identification cards, which would allow undocumented immigrants to open bank accounts. A landmark move since New Haven would be the first in the nation to ever approve a municipal ID program. Please join me, Denise Manzari, on Monday, July 2nd at 8 p.m. for a two-hour special as I fill in for Scott Harris on his Counterpoint program to examine the many complex issues of immigration, from foreign policies and trade agreements to Border Patrol. Among other interviewees will be New Haven Mayor John DeStefano, who will discuss the subsequent ICE raids and arrests of 31 undocumented immigrants in his city 2 days after the ID card approval vote. So tune in and phone in your ideas and opinions on Monday, July 2nd at 8 p.m. for a two-hour special on immigration here on WPKN Radio in Bridgeport, at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk 88.7 FM. That's Monday, July 2nd at 8 p.m.
And Denise will be filling in for me 2 Mondays from now. That's July 2nd with an immigration special, as you just heard. So tune in for that. That'll be a jam-packed couple of hours worth of a lot of information about especially what's going on in New Haven locally here. And we'll get a little bit of some interviews I conducted at a march in New Haven this past Saturday afternoon in the Fairhaven district, where a lot of people protested against the ICE, the federal ICE raids there that followed very closely 2 days after the ID card program was approved. So that's coming up later tonight. But right now I'd like to welcome to the program Paul Waldman. He is a senior fellow at Media Matters for America based in Washington and author of the book Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. Paul, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So Media Matters just released a very intriguing report titled The Progressive Majority, Why a Conservative America is a Myth. Tell us about that.
Well, this is something we've heard a lot for a long time, not just from conservatives themselves, but also from reporters. You find that, let's say there's an election and Republicans win, what do the analyses after the election tell us? Well, they tell us that this happened because America is basically a conservative country. It's a center-right country. It's socially conservative. It's conservative on economic issues and on national security issues and on social issues, and that's why the Republicans won. When the Democrats win an election, we're not told that that's what happened. We're not told that the country is moving to the left. What we're told is that it was just some kind of accident of history. In 2006, it was the war. Previous years, it was something else. But it's a completely different interpretation. And in the time in between the elections, we see that kind of idea dropped into news reports all the time, that this is basically a conservative country. So we set out to examine all of the available evidence to really find out if we could put our finger on, as best we could, where do the American people really stand ideologically? And so we gathered together evidence from the most nonpartisan sources we could find, going back as far as we could find. Things like the General Social Survey that's done at the University of Chicago, the National Election Studies, which are done from the University of Michigan, data from organizations like the Pew Research Center and Gallup. And what you find when you look at all of this data is that on issue after issue, in area after area, America is not a conservative country. In fact, it is an extraordinarily progressive country. But that is just getting lost in those kinds of stereotypes and these myths that get repeated over and over. So this report lays out in a whole wide variety of areas exactly what it is that makes America so progressive and where people really stand on the issues.
You've broken this report out into a number of issue areas, as you said. Maybe you could go through some of the specifics regarding the economy, health care, social security, immigration, energy, a lot of the other issues that you covered, because, as you said, there is this kind of myth or, you would have to say, kind of this generalization of the population and where they are at politically when polls tell a different story.
Sure. We started off by talking about the role of government. And this is one of the core conservative tenets, that we need government to be as small as possible. That's really one of what I like to call the four pillars of conservatism: small government, low taxes, strong defense, traditional values. And those are supposed to be very popular. But when you actually look at how pollsters have asked this question, what you find is that people don't actually say that they want a smaller government. They, by pretty substantial majorities, on the order of 60% or so, they say they want a government that's pretty fairly big and does a lot of things. They wanted to be involved in the economy. They wanted to be involved in regulation. They'd rather have a government that did more, even if it spent more, than a government that did less in order to cut spending. They also want a government that cares for people who can't care for themselves by substantial margins. On those kind of broad questions, what you see is that that's really where the people are, despite the appeal of the kind of small government bumper sticker. Now, when you get to, let's talk about, say, some economic issues. Congress just passed an increase in the minimum wage the first time in 10 years. They had to shoehorn it into an Iraq appropriation bill. But It turns out the support for increasing the minimum wage, even though this is a clear divide between Democrats and Republicans, between progressives and conservatives, around 80% of the public supports an increase in the minimum wage. Unions, despite the fact that they are on their backs in many ways politically and have been under assault really since the Reagan administration, clear majorities of the public says that unions are a good thing. They have a positive view of unions. They think that more people should be unionized. When we get to taxes, this is another area where conservatives have very effectively kind of distilled their ideology down to a bumper sticker, and they say they want low taxes. Sounds good. Nobody likes paying taxes, right? Everyone would be happy to have their taxes be lower. But it turns out when you really talk to Americans about this, they have a much more nuanced view. They may not like paying taxes, but they also understand that upper-income people and corporations get away with not paying enough in taxes. They think that the taxes are not fair. If you ask them, would you rather cut taxes or have some kind of an economic agenda that focused on investing in the country, they will opt for the investments, the government spending over tax cuts. My pretty clear majority is they don't think that the Bush tax cuts have had a very positive effect. And so that's an area where even though the assumption is that, well, you know, Republicans favor tax cuts and tax cuts are popular, actually people have a much more complicated view of things that's much more friendly to a progressive approach. Things like health care. And very large majorities of the American people want a national health care system. The environment, huge, overwhelming majorities, 80-90% in some cases, depending on what question you're asking, want strong environmental protections. And then let's talk about social issues, and I think this is really one of the most interesting ones. We have this assumption that on the social issues, Americans are very conservative. You know, this is a very traditional country, If you ask conservatives that, they'll say, well, you know, look at where we are on these sort of hot-button issues. Democrats are always on the defensive about abortion and gay marriage, and that just shows how conservative the public is. Well, the fact is, if you take abortion, first of all, about 60% of the public doesn't want to overturn Roe v. Wade. There's a clear pro-choice majority, even if conservatives have been successful on some of those kind of ancillary issues like parental consent and partial birth abortion. On the basic question of should abortion be legal or not, it's clear that there is a significant pro-choice majority. And then things like gay marriage, I think this is really interesting because I've had conservatives tell me this. They say, well, you know, look, only 40% or so of the public is in support of gay marriage, so that just proves how conservative we are. Well, let's step back and think about this for a moment. There may be no issue that I can think of that opinions are moving as rapidly as they have on gay rights issues and as moving as rapidly to the left. I mean, 4 years ago, Howard Dean started to run for president, and all the pundits said that even though he was a pretty successful governor, he couldn't really get the support of very many of the American people because he was really outside the mainstream. And what was the evidence for that? He had signed a civil unions bill in Vermont. Now, it's 4 years later, forget about the fortunes of Howard Dean and his campaign, civil unions, which was supposed to be this wild, wacky, left-wing, out-of-the-mainstream position, that's now the median position of the American voter. That's the middle. That's where the middle is. The left may be in support of gay marriage, and the right is in support of no legal recognition. But the middle position is what was once, just a couple of years ago, the wacky left position. And the whole conversation around gay rights has changed, has been transformed. Nobody was even thinking about gay marriage 5 or 10 years ago. And it really parallels a whole series of changes that have taken place since the 1960s. If you think back before the 1960s, what were the conservative positions on these kinds of social issues? Well, the conservative position, for instance, was that women should not work outside the home, and if they did, then they shouldn't be paid as much as men. That was a conservative position. And the idea of gender equality was something that was considered kind of radical. That was the radical left-wing position. Well, now that's the consensus position. There's no one, no conservative even, who will get up and say that women shouldn't be paid the same as men for doing the same work. The entire country has moved to the left, and that's happened on a whole series of social issues. It's happening on gay rights, and I think when you step back, you can really see that as a clear demonstration that the country is not only not conservative right now, but it's becoming less conservative over time.
Well, I think, you know, the key thing in this study and other studies that have investigated similar issues in the American politic is that you've got elections and then you've got polls. And, of course, elections are influenced by our media and their presentation of the issues, their biases, their omissions, their exclusion of certain points of view and details and facts surrounding those points of view. And it seems to me that is the critical issue here that's been brought up by your study. Maybe you could address that for us. The connection between elections and these polls and the disconnect that you have between public opinion and the outcome of elections.
Right. It is an imperfect connection. You know, I mentioned the minimum wage. It took 10 years to get an increase in the minimum wage, even though virtually all of the American people, or at least 4 out of 5 Americans, wanted it to happen. Elections are similar. Elections are extremely complicated, and they're not just decided on issues. And actually, this is really the problem that Democrats have had for a long time, is that they have been sort of naive in this belief that elections are decided on issues, and all that they have to do is to go out and talk about the issues, and then everything will be fine. And they look at the public opinion data that tells them that they have this advantage, you know, that the things that they want to do are popular, and they say, well, we'll just go out and we'll talk about the issues, and then we'll win. And so you have Democrats who come out and say, well, you know, if you just read my 10-point plan, then I'm sure you will see that my 10-point plan is superior to my opponent's, and then you will vote for me. Then the Republican comes out, and he knows the same thing. He knows he doesn't have the advantage on the issue. So what does he say? He doesn't talk about his 10-point plan. He says, he points to the Democrat, and he says, that guy hates you and everything you stand for. He is a weak, effeminate, northeastern liberal who doesn't share your values. And the Republicans have understood that it's those kinds of things, those kind of personal identity questions, on which elections turn. Now, issues are important in elections, but issues tend to be a vehicle through which those kinds of character arguments are made. And so it's not that that issues don't matter at all. I mean, there's only so long you can do a song and dance around an issue. You know, I think the 2006 elections were, in part, showed evidence of this, that the Republicans really came out and did the same old thing that they always do, which is that, you know, Democrats want defeat. If you vote for Democrats, then we're all going to die. And it just wouldn't wash anymore. The public had really had it with that. And that was part of the reason why the Democrats won. But the Republicans really have gotten much, much better at most of the aspects of campaigning than Democrats have been, particularly on the presidential level. You know, I think that there really is this sort of imperfect connection between the policy agenda that the public wants and who they end up pulling that lever for. And it's also important to remember that most people, and this is something that I think is hard for a lot of those of us who are immersed in politics and care deeply about it and think about it all the time, it's hard for us to keep in mind. Most Americans don't really care very much about politics. They don't, you know, spend 8 hours a day reading blogs and 3 different newspapers and thinking all about all these issues. They catch a little bit of the local news while they're fixing dinner for their kids. And if you actually look at what people know and understand about the political world, it's not very much. And a lot of people don't have a very good sense of where the two parties stand on the issues. They don't really necessarily have a good grasp of what divides the Democrats from the Republicans. And so they don't go into the voting booth with this sort of checklist that says, well, you know, I agree with the candidate X on the minimum wage, and I agree with the candidate Y on taxes, and I agree with the candidate X on this and the candidate Y on that. That's not how people vote. They get a sense of who the candidates are and who they can trust and who they feel is honest and those kinds of things. And that's how that's the basis on which they vote. And then they may or may not get disappointed when it turns out that person's agenda doesn't line up with what they'd like to do. But when it comes time to election day, people don't really vote on that checklist. And that's been a big problem that Democrats have had, is sort of believing that people are checklist voters. And they really aren't, because most of them don't really necessarily have a good grasp on what differentiates the parties. And, you know, another argument that's sometimes offered as to why, for evidence for this myth that America is conservative, is that if you ask people, you know, do you consider yourself a conservative or a liberal or a moderate, there are many more people who will say conservative than will say liberal. And I've had people, even Democrats, say to me, well, look at that. Doesn't that mean that this is a conservative country and Democrats have to move to the center? Well, not really, because if you look then at those people who say they're moderates, or those people who say they're liberals, and those people who say they're conservatives, if you look what they actually believe about issues, it turns out that people aren't really classifying themselves in the way that people in Washington or people who care a lot about politics would classify themselves. There's this assumption that if somebody answers a poll and says, yes, I'm a moderate, that means that they're beliefs about issues must be, you know, dead center between the Democrats and the Republicans. But if you look at what people who call themselves moderates to pollsters believe, it turns out that they're very, very liberal. They, you know, they want to raise the minimum wage. They want strong environmental protections. They want a national health care program. They look almost identical to the people who call themselves liberals. And even some of the conservatives are very liberal on issues, people who say that they're conservative. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Partly it's because people just don't necessarily have a good sense of what those words really mean in the political arena. And partly it's the campaign against the word liberal to demonize it that has been going on for the last 25 years or so. And it's been very, very effective.
We're speaking with Paul Waldman, senior fellow at the Media Matters for America organization based in Washington, and we're talking about a Media Matters study just released titled The Progressive Majority, Why a Conservative America is a Myth. And just to get to the media role in this, Paul, because as you said, a lot of people don't go to the polls armed with the facts about where the parties stand, where the candidates stand. And again, I have to go back to the flaws in our media system, where the media's role has failed to separate the wheat from the chaff. I mean, yeah, people are called traitors to this country. They hate America. They're effete liberal snobs from a Northeast state. Yeah, all that said in the campaign. But when it comes to issues like energy or health care or taxation, a lot of people don't get the essential information that is now leading them, because they don't have it, to vote against their own best interests. You know, in terms of voting for candidates, they're going to keep their taxes relatively high and give billions of dollars of tax breaks to the wealthy who have nothing to do with them. And again, a lot of people are going to the polls without the information essential as citizens to know, you know, what's what, who's up, who's down, who's for me, who's for the other guy.
Yes, and you're right. And political reporters don't do a very good job of informing people. They tend to be pretty bored by issues, and they spend a lot of time talking about character. Now, character is important in the president. I think that, you know, looking back over the last 6.5 years, there are a lot of things that were evident about George Bush's character that ended up being pretty disastrous for the country that we should have spent more time thinking about, perhaps. But the way that reporters talk about character tends not to be very helpful. You know, they seize on these sort of stereotypes and then channel all their coverage through them. And so, you know, once they decide that John Kerry really is an out-of-touch liberal, then that's how they talk about him, and that's how they report on him, and it becomes impossible for him to break out of that stereotype because it keeps getting repeated over and over and over by those reporters. I mean, let's take an example from the Kerry campaign. The John Edwards haircut. How many hundreds and hundreds of stories has that been mentioned in? Why? Well, it just happens that that's exactly what Republicans want people to think of when they think of John Edwards, that he's some sort of, some sort of hypocrite because he's a rich person who thinks that we shouldn't have poverty anymore, as though there's something hypocritical about that. It's not as though he's actually saying that everyone should be poor, quite the opposite. He actually wants people not to be poor. But, you know, he got an expensive haircut. And the reporters love things like that. They seize them and they say, we're just going to keep mentioning this over and over and over and over again. And every time he brings up something about talking about poverty, or he talks about the minimum wage, or he talks about what ordinary people need to do to get by, they're going to toss in a reference to that $400 haircut and say, he's just a big phony. Well, it turns out that that's exactly what the Republicans want you to believe. That's what they want you to think when they think of John Edwards. Now, in contrast, Republicans always build their campaigns around the idea that their candidate is strong and manly and a father figure and a man of the people, someone who understands ordinary folks and the kind of guy you'd like to have at your backyard barbecue and share beer with. And it turns out that in election after election, reporters buy into that completely. I mean, let's just take the example of George W. Bush. You could probably count on one hand the number of people in the United States of America who were blessed with the kind of advantages that he was, of wealth and power. A father who was a president, a grandfather who was a senator, Andover and Yale and Harvard. In 1999, he bought that ranch where he goes down and clears brush every weekend, or however often he goes down to clear that seemingly inexhaustible supply of brush. It was purchased in 1999 because he and Karl Rove understood well that they could create that association, the iconic image of the cowboy, and it would be very useful in helping to create this idea that George Bush really is a man of the people, who is someone who's just a regular guy. Now, there you could not come up with a phonier image than that one. There was nothing authentic about it. But yet, we were told over and over and over by reporters that George Bush was the authentic one. And Al Gore, and then 4 years later John Kerry, they were inauthentic. They weren't real. They couldn't really connect with regular people. Whereas George Bush, who had more advantages than either one of them, even though both Gore and Kerry also came from very privileged backgrounds, that they were inauthentic and phony, and Bush was the real one. And you know, we're seeing it again. You know, the coming candidacy of Fred Thompson. Fred Thompson is somebody who's lauded over and over again for the fact that he's supposed to be this, you know, this regular guy who has this terrific Southern accent and can really relate to the folks and comes from the South. Well, what you don't almost never hear about Fred Thompson is that he spent 20 years in Washington as a high-priced lobbyist, and that when he ran for Senate, he rented a pickup truck that he would drive the last couple of blocks to an event and then stand up in the bed of the pickup truck and give a speech. But all these stories about Fred Thompson now talk about that red pickup truck and how it just charmed the people of Tennessee because he was such a down-to-earth kind of guy. Well, you know, it was phony. It was theater. And there are parts, you know, when Fred Thompson goes up and talks about how, you know, how he can't stand Washington, you know, he has this joke about how, oh, you know, I spent 8 years as a senator, and after 8 years in Washington, I longed for the authenticity of Hollywood, and everyone laughs. But of course, he didn't just spend 8 years in Washington. He spent almost 30 years in Washington. The other 20 were working as a lobbyist. Now, that stuff, reporters look at that and they say, eh, you know, we're not going to bother to put that in our story. But they're going to make sure that they get in that expensive haircut into every John Edwards story.
Well, it's a sad commentary on the state of our media. And given that the airwaves on radio and television are really the public's airwaves, we really have to find a way to take our media back from these corporations whose agenda often lines up with the pro-corporate party, which no doubt has a great effect on the editors and publishers of newspapers, the news directors at radio and TV stations, and how the news is spun, how labor and environmentalists and other interest groups are excluded or marginalized in the reporting, and again, leading to the misinformation, the lack of facts and information regarding our politics in this country, which, of course, leads people to make uninformed choices in the ballot box.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you know, it's kind of an irony of our current media situation is that on the one hand, we've had this multiplication of sources, and there's all kinds of different places you can get information now, especially on the Internet. But at the same time, we've had a consolidation of media companies and fewer and fewer sources of information in many ways. And the fact is that as fantastic as the Internet is for political information, I say this as someone who spends a couple hours a day reading blogs, most people don't do that. And most people are still getting their information from those few very large media companies. And so it's important to keep an eye on them and see what we can do to make them do their jobs better.
And you do a great job over at Media Matters with the conservative misinformation reports that come out every week or sometimes more than often than, you know, twice a week. So tell our listeners as we conclude here, Paul, how they can get a copy of this particular report, The Progressive Majority, Why a Conservative America is a Myth, and then get a lot of the other information and the media monitoring that you do at Media Matters off your website and maybe a phone number as well for we don't have everybody on the Internet who's a listener right now.
We do everything that Media Matters does goes through our website. And so you can go to mediamatters.org, you can see every day we put up about a dozen different items on different kinds of misinformation that's coursing through the media. And there you can also sign up for different kinds of alerts. You can get every single item emailed to you. You can get an email once a day. You can get an email once a week. You can get emails on just certain issues if you like. We have all different kinds of ways you can do that. For this report, you can search for it on our website. You can also go to mediamatters.org/progmaj, as in Progressive Majority. That's a special site just for this report. And I would encourage people to do that, hopefully every day, because there's all kinds of good stuff that we put up on our website every day.
All right, Paul. So is there a phone number over there? Just because I said it, not everybody's got Internet access. Is there a number, the main number people can call?
We don't have a phone number that's just for people to get information. I mean, we have numbers for press and things like that, but people really have to go to the website if they want to see what we're doing.
Okay, so they'll have to go to the library, which hopefully are still open.
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks for all your work on this, Paul. Appreciate it.
That's my pleasure.
All right. Take care.
Yep.
Bye-bye. That was Paul Waldman, senior fellow at Media Matters for America and author of the book, Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. And again, the title of the report we've been discussing tonight is The Progressive Majority, Why a Conservative America is a Myth. It's 3 minutes after 9 o'clock. This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. Do stay with us. We're going to be back talking about the Iraq War and a special campaign that begins shortly called Iraq Summer, modeled on the Civil Rights Summer that happened not all that many decades ago. So we're going to take a short musical break and be back in a moment. This is Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris.
All right, we're going to fix that technical problem.
ABC,
NBC,
CBS,
CNN,
Fox News,
breaking news,
faking news, the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
At ABC News, work at CNN,
to see so many colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration.
Thank you, sir.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message.
Media war.
Managing the message.
Media war.
All the networks wanted to have was a countdown to war.
Overemphasis.
Overkill. 48 hours to war. Dun, 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 dun. Showdown to Saddam.
The purpose of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Mr. Secretary. Just follow up on Jimmy's question a little bit. I thought I answered that.
Media war.
The outcome is assured.
Everybody wanted to see Ted Koppel running down the desert in a Hummer.
Based on the Humvee used by the U.S. military, it is one smooth ride. And being so high up above everyone else, everyone gets out of your way. You've got a great view of the road. But that sense of empowerment doesn't come cheap. The Hummer only gets about 12 miles to the gallon up.
What about Al Jazeera and that, publishing those gruesome pictures of dead soldiers?
I think there's something that is culturally Arab about that.
You know, I'm looking forward to some tapes of dead people. Osama bin Laden dead, Saddam Hussein dead. I certainly put those on Fox News.
And that's Special Report for this time. News. Fair, balanced, and unafraid.
Media war.
Either with us or you're against us.
Pavlov talked about the power of repetition. We are getting a message, a media message that's repeated over and over again. Saddam, Saddam, Saddam. Evil, evil, evil. Saddam, Saddam, Saddam. Evil, evil.
Corporate-owned media is slanted and biased.
What about the issue of challenging the corporate media?
Move on the media. Press the press. I think that the coverage will change. Press the press. Press the press. Press the press.
Media war.
With us or your guests. With us or your guests.
The whole thing's being treated like infotainment.
The outcome is assured.
This is a spectacle for consumption.
They don't report anything that is in any way critical of Bush. And that's worse than Goebbels in World War II. And I'm from Germany. I know how Goebbels treated the war. You should be ashamed of yourself.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Secretary.
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 Last question.
This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM, WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. The program is Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris. And right now I'd like to welcome to the program Moira Mack. She is spokesperson with the group Americans Against Escalation in Iraq. Moira, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Scott.
Scott. Thanks for having me.
Glad you can make it. I was very interested to hear about a campaign that you're helping to organize this summer called Iraq Summer. And it's an organized way to pressure various representatives and U.S. senators in advance of the 2008 election and some critical votes coming up in Congress on funding of the Iraq War. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Iraq Summer, what it's all about, and the inspiration that it comes from?
Sure, thanks. Yeah, we're really excited about the Iraq Summer program that we're launching right now. Actually, as we speak, we have nearly 100 organizers gathered in the Washington area for training, and they're getting ready to deploy to their states. 100 organizers are deploying to 15 states to pressure more than 40 members of Congress on the war in Iraq. And basically, Americans Against Escalation in Iraq has been working toward a responsible end to the war through all sorts of grassroots events, letters to the editor, calls to Congress, online mobilizations. We're a broad coalition, and many of our coalition partners have used paid advertising. And at this point, we just really feel it's a critical time to begin moving members of Congress on their votes so that we can finally bring an end to this war. So we're deploying 100 organizers out into the states armed with a deep knowledge of the war in Iraq and the policy, and they will be contacting voters and knocking on doors and talking to community leaders. You know, using the power of grassroots communication to spread the word and put pressure on members of Congress to let them know that the majority of Americans are looking for a responsible end to this war, which, I mean, we all know is really true. I mean, opposition to the war in Iraq has reached a boiling point. The president's approval numbers are the lowest that they've ever been. And Americans are looking for a way out of this mess. So that's really what we're focused on this summer.
I didn't want to go through every congressional district that you're targeting, but give us an overview. Give us an overview, if you would, of the various congresspersons and U.S. senators that you are going to be putting pressure on.
Sure. Well, we're going to be putting pressure on Senators Collins and Snow in Maine. Both of those senators have, you know, spoken at home about being critical of the president's war policy, but then every time they vote, they continue to vote with President Bush and allow him to continue his reckless war policy that their constituents are against. And we also are going to be in Illinois. We'll be pressuring Congressman Kirk, Congressman Johnson, and Congressman LaHood. That's another area where they're just the members of Congress are just out of touch with their constituents. Congressman Kirk's district, it's a suburban district, and we've seen polling that suburban voters are turning strongly against this reckless war and the president's war policy. You know, it's really amazing and astonishing that these members of Congress are so blatantly ignoring the feelings of their constituents. So that's really what we're going to be working to do in districts like that. We're also going to be in Minnesota, where Senator Coleman is a target, as well as two of their representatives, Representative Ramstead and Representative Bachman, because Minnesota is another state where the public is overwhelmingly looking for an exit strategy, looking for a timeline to end the war. So we'll be working there across the state as well. Other states, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Arizona, Iowa, New Mexico, Nevada, Delaware, will be in 15 states for the Iraq Summer Program. But we actually also work already with a large network of a large coalition, and the coalition partners that we work with are located in many states all across the country. So we'll continue work to at a smaller level all across the country. We won't be ignoring members of Congress where we aren't stationing organizers for Iraq Summer.
Now, in terms of the activities, it takes a lot to capture media attention, and I know you're probably going to be at some point going door to door, grassroots organizing, meeting people at shopping centers and the like. But give us some idea of the creative ways that you're going to use to reach out to ordinary citizens to let them know, you can fight City Hall and you can win.
Well, I think, the most important thing I think that we're going to be doing is making it clear to the members of Congress who we are pressuring that they have a simple choice. They can choose to side with the majority of the public and vote for an end to the war, or they can choose political extinction. And how are we going to demonstrate that? We're going to demonstrate that absolutely by bringing out all of the people in their districts who are already passionately against this war and give them opportunities to show it. We'll be having rallies and protests. We'll be having town halls and inviting these members to come and defend their previous votes and encourage them and urge them and plead with them to change their votes and start voting against President Bush and his reckless policy. We've used a whole variety of campaign tactics with the Americans Against Escalation in Iraq campaign thus far. We've already used planes with banners behind them at the Republican presidential debates saying, mission accomplished, Republicans, and, asking them if they agreed with President Bush on his 50-year plan to stay in Iraq for 50 years, like in South Korea. And we'll be free to use planes. We'll be free to use mobile billboards like we've used in the past as well. We've used bus station signs. We have signs at our disposal. We'll be looking at doing lawn signs and holding all sorts of creative events to let our members know that all across their district. Families are passionate about this issue. The voters are passionate about this issue. And I think another way that we're going to be getting at our message that's really effective is that we work closely with veterans and military families. Veterans and military families are extremely passionate about this war and about the recklessness of the president's policy. President Bush's policy has really been weighing on military families and the troops more than anyone else. And I think the Walter Reed scandal opens some folks' eyes to the fact that despite all the rhetoric, President Bush is not really backing up his claims to support the troops. But no one knows it better than military families and the veterans. They've been shortchanged with the training. The president and the administration have broken commitments to them in terms of the time off in between deployments. They've extended their deployments. It puts a huge strain on military families. After the veterans come home, we've seen the scandals of the health care and the mental health care facilities, how they're all lacking. So certainly, we'll be using, veterans and military families' voices all throughout the country. We actually do have organizers that are working with us on Iraq Summer who are Iraq veterans. We have the mother of an Iraq veteran also, and I think that they really give a personal glimpse into what this war is doing to Americans. And I would also say that there's the issue of the National Guard. The National Guardsmen have been deployed and that's affecting our communities. National Guardsmen are folks who play vital roles in our communities every day, and when they're sent off to Iraq, it causes strain in our communities. And we've seen a huge amount of press about the equipment shortages that result from the National Guard being sent out to Iraq as well. And it caused problems in Kansas with tornado response, and we're seeing concerns about that all across the country right now. So there are, you know, a variety of issues that have resulted from the reckless war policy of this president. And I think, you know, that we have a variety of ways that we can pressure members of Congress and show them that this policy is wrong for America, it's wrong for our troops, and it's wrong for our communities.
We're speaking with Moira Mack, and she's a spokesperson with the group Americans Against Escalation in Iraq. And we're talking about a campaign they are initiating this summer called Iraq Summer, targeting 40 Republican House members and U.S. senators who are continuing to back President Bush's Iraq war policies. Moira, there are a good number of Democrats who, you know, voted for this funding bill, you know, just this past month. And there's a lot of anger out in the country for the Democrats not coming through on their promise to end this war as they did during the 2006 election. Why is this campaign not targeting some of those Democrats?
Well, our strategy is to isolate President Bush and force him to abandon his policy of endless war in Iraq. And we believe the best way to do that is by moving these Republican members, and I think that's the most effective way to increase pressure on the president. We saw that we passed through Congress a timeline for a responsible end to the war, and President Bush vetoed it. And although, you know, we haven't been happy with all of the Democratic votes, and we were frustrated. We were frustrated that Democrats weren't able to finish the job after the president's veto. We really see that it's the Republicans in Congress who refuse to leave Bush's side who are obstructing the will of the American people. So our focus is primarily on Republican members, but certainly any Democrats who vote the wrong way. You know, we'll be watching for those, and we're gonna respond to every member of Congress who votes the wrong way and opposes and obstructs a responsible end to the war in Iraq. So, you know, I think it's a matter of really just splitting off Republicans from President Bush's side, and I think we're really seeing you know, a start to that. You know, there's been a much plugged report from General Petraeus, slated for September, that a lot of Republicans were hanging their hat on. It seemed pretty clear to a lot of folks that the policy of President Bush was reckless. His escalation was not working, and that this September report would result in nothing good. You know, now we have confirmation of that. You know, the Pentagon has metrics out now showing that the president's policy has not quelled violence and increased. It's actually increased in casualties and bombings. And we're seeing the Republicans starting to react to that. You know, the president's September promise was a way to keep Republicans from splitting off and to encourage them to stick with him for a couple more months, despite all of the public pressure on them to vote for a responsible end to the war. And I don't think after this summer of Iraq summer, we'll be seeing nearly so many Republicans standing with President Bush. I think we're going to see them fall away from him rather quickly, because we're already seeing the preview of the September report. General Petraeus himself is saying that we're not going to see a report that says you know, that the policy is succeeding in September. So I think, you know, we're beginning to see it. Senator McConnell was out on the Sunday shows over the weekend and gave an indication that folks are looking for a change in policy and looking to reduce troops probably in the fall. So I think that we're going to see them falling away. Now, our job is just to increase that pressure on members of Congress, make sure that they know that if they don't vote for an end to the war, that they're going to face political extinction, and also make sure that they vote for real legislation that will bring a responsible end to the war, a timeline to end the war. And that's going to be the focus of our work this summer.
Moira.
And I think they've really gotten the message. I mean, all of the public polling out there shows that the majority of Americans have had enough of the president's policy.
We're speaking with Moira Mack, and again, we're discussing the campaign that's being launched this summer called Iraq Summer to put pressure on Republican legislators in the House and Senate who are supporting the president's Iraq war policies, and fielding 40 organizers in 40 congressional districts and states is an expensive proposition, Moira. How is this being funded? Is this a what groups are behind this? What organizational, what coalitions have come together to support this with funding?
Sure. Well, our coalition is a broad coalition, and a lot of wonderful groups working with us. Some of those groups are VoteVets.org, an Iraq and Afghanistan veterans group, MoveOn.org, True Majority, Working Assets, SEIU. Center for American Progress. It's a large number of groups that are working with us. U.S. Action is a group that we work with that has field staff in 24 states. So that's in addition to the 15 states where we'll be for Iraq Summer, and we work with them closely too. So there are all sorts of groups that are contributing to this campaign. And I think it makes it a much stronger one that we have a wide variety of groups, and a lot of these groups, like MoveOn.org and Working Assets and True Majority, have great online campaigns that are going to be vital to Iraq Summer, because they can turn out their online members to our events, to our rallies, to our protests. And make sure that everyone in the community knows about these events and can come out and let our members of Congress know that that we're looking for a responsible end to the war.
Okay. Well, Moira, I wanted to also just ask you a bit about the goals in the 2008 election. When you take a look at the congressional districts that you're targeting, is there any sense that there's a certain critical numbers of seats that have to change in the House or Senate to enable an end to the Iraq war to be legislated, be passed in the form of a bill? What kind of calculations are going into these 40 districts, and what is the desired outcome here?
Well, I can say that I certainly I don't think that the selection of these targets is not because we hope to get votes based on changing seats. I think we're looking to get these votes on the Iraq war now. Definitely, we're looking to get these votes on the war in Iraq before the 2008 election, and that is the goal here. But I can say that, some of these districts are completely chosen based on members that we think can be convinced to vote for an end to the war, because that's what, that's the goal. That's what we want to do. And so these are members who might be likely to vote for a responsible end to the war because of their statements, because of previous votes. But, a lot of it's because of their statements, and a lot of it's because of the public in their district. A wide variety of Americans all across the country are looking for a responsible end to the war, but we selected the members of Congress who we think we can move because the people in their district are extremely, extremely angry about their votes and extremely irate about the war, and are looking for a responsible end to the war. And so we selected folks based on their record and a combination of that and their districts and their districts' anti-war sentiment.
So it's not necessarily to replace these people in Congress. It's really to move very quickly to change their votes on these critical votes on Iraq war funding and the like.
Absolutely. It's we're looking sooner than the 2008 elections to move these votes along and start bringing a responsible end to the war. Now, I do think that that a lot of members of Congress are feeling politically vulnerable right now, and that's what we're talking about with political extinction. So, some of these members might be looking at their seat and looking at their public, and they're going to do the math. So certainly that's the case for some of these folks that, you know, they're feeling politically vulnerable. They see that all of their constituents are irate, showing up everywhere they go, waving their wrong way signs, Iraq war wrong way, stop the escalation, bring a responsible end to the war. They're gonna think twice about that, and that's what we're talking about with political extinction. But certainly, you know, we are passionate about the Iraq war issue, and folks that don't vote the right way, you know, we don't want them voting. We don't want them there.
Right.
And I think that a lot of voters, the Iraq war is the number one issue for them. We've seen polling that shows that. Recently, something I thought was pretty interesting, Donald Trump came out. He's kind of an independent voter, but he came out and said that he is a single issue voter on the Iraq war. And he is looking for someone who will get us out of Iraq. I think there's a growing group of independents like that that are looking for an end to the war, and that politicians are starting to realize they've really got to pay attention to it. And our hope is by the end of this summer that we'll have moved enough members of Congress that we can finally bring a responsible end to this war.
Right. There's some critical votes, of course, in September. And then, as you said earlier, there's this progress report that's supposed to come out also in September. So it could be a key time for turning the tide on the Iraq war, and especially the funding coming through Congress. Moira, we're out of time here, but please do leave our listeners, if you would, with a phone number as well as a web address so people can get more information about the Iraq Summer Project and how they can get involved.
Absolutely. Our web address is www.noiraqescalation.com. We don't have a phone number, but if you go there, there's a spot where you can contact us and you can see more information about our campaign. And we're going to be building up the website even more so that folks can learn about what we're doing over the summer with our big summer campaign.
Okay, so that's No Iraq Escalation, all there in lined up words with no spaces, noiraqescalation.com.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, good luck on the campaign, Moira, and appreciate you making time to talk with us about all the details of it tonight.
Thank you so much, Scott.
All right, best of luck with it.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Moira Mack, spokesperson for the group Americans Against Escalation in Iraq, all about the Iraq Summer Campaign and trying to pressure office holders in the House and Senate to change their views and votes on the Iraq War. And again, the website again is noiraqescalation.com. Musical break coming up here, and then we're going to be talking about Joe Lieberman and a demonstration that was held in Washington, D.C. not too long ago by a group from Code Pink, and there's some other demonstrations against Joe Lieberman, U.S. Senator from Connecticut, which will be happening this week. We'll tell you some details about that as well. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Sun.
music by Michael Franti and Spearhead, something called Yell Fire is the album that came from, and that particular cut was called I Know I'm Not Alone. It's 9:32 here on WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. My name is Scott Harris. The program is Counterpoint, and we're glad you could join us tonight. And coming up to our final segment this evening, we're now joined by Leslie Angeline, as she's an activist with Code Pink, who has taken an interest and a lead in confronting Connecticut U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman about some of his remarks about his stated desire that the United States should seriously consider military action against the nation of Iran. And he told CBS television two Sundays ago, quote, I think we've got to be prepared to take aggressive military action against the Iranians to stop them from killing Americans in Iraq. And this, of course, is not even directed at the Bush administration's threat of the use of military force against Iran's nuclear programs, but instead focused on the Bush administration's allegations that Iran is somehow fueling the insurgency against the U.S. forces in Iraq and the Shia-dominated government in Iraq, which many of them, of course, are close allies of the nation of Iran and its government. But right now, to talk about this issue is Leslie Angeline, as I said, an activist with Code Pink. Thanks for joining us, Leslie.
Sure, absolutely.
Glad you could be here. Just maybe tell us a little bit, before we talk about a recent trip you took to Iran, say a few words about a recent sit-in and a demonstration that you had at Joe Lieberman's office in Washington just shortly after he made those remarks about wanting the United States to seriously consider an attack on Iran.
Yes, he went on Face the Nation, and he suggested using military force. And I had just gotten to D.C. on Saturday night and was considering what I wanted to do to promote peace with Iran. And when I heard the statement that night, I decided to go on the hunger strike. And so we went into his office that next morning and Monday morning and asked for a meeting and were denied. So the next day we went in on Tuesday and were planning a sit-in, and they gave us an appointment within 20 minutes of being there for Thursday afternoon at 4:30. So we were all very excited. We contacted the Iranian community, and we had some very excellent speakers who know a lot about the politics of Iran. I mostly know what I experienced, which was the people. But the policy I'm not as well read about yet. So we had some excellent speakers lined up, and we went to Lieberman's at 4:30, and the meeting was canceled. So there were about 60 activists from many different members of different peace movements. There was the Vets Against the War in Iraq. There was a Iranian community. There was a man for just foreign policy who was one of the speakers. And then there was a lot of Code Pink and other military families against the war. So we went into Lieberman's office, and Medea made an appeal to please keep their promise and let us talk with Lieberman. And then she motioned to me to start speaking, and as soon as I started to talk, I started to cry and then immediately started to sob. And that's just as the chief of staff came out to find out what all the commotion was about. The police were threatening to arrest us. And when she saw all of this emotion and all of these people in the office, she and Medea talked for a moment and said, okay, well, Medea can stay in the office. Everyone else out in the hall, and I'll see what I can do. And a few minutes later, she came out and said that she had arranged a meeting with herself, a legislative director, and a legislative assistant who works on the Middle East. So we spoke with them. There were three of us that were allowed in the office with the staff people. I went as the person who had just visited Iran, and then Ross with the Iranian community, and Robert with a Just Foreign Policy went in. And we spoke, and it was quite a wonderful discussion in that I felt like both sides were very open to listening and also to exchanging their ideas, and both the staff and the people in the peace movement admitted that there were points that the others had made that were valid, and I, as people were talking, slowly put out photographs that I had taken, my boyfriend and I had taken in Iran, of children and families and women. And I noticed the staffers looking at the pictures as they were debating in the office, and particularly the chief of staff. She was a woman, and she would move the pictures to look at another picture a second or a third time, and I could see that she was moved. She would look at me, she would smile, and then she'd look at the pictures again. And at the end of the meeting, we felt like we'd been heard. The people who were with me said, you know, I felt like it was a good discussion. We've said what we needed to, which was nice, because it wasn't the staffers who said, okay, we've given you enough time, now we need to be on our way. It was the people who I was with who said, okay, we feel like we've been heard and we've had a good discussion here. And at the very end, the chief of staff hugged me really strongly. And so I do feel like I was able to move them a little on an emotional level, and the men I was with were able to move them on an intellectual level. So it felt successful, and I decided to stop my hunger strike, and we celebrated at Bus Boys and Poets, where a lot of us went and had food and talked and celebrated the fact that there was diplomacy in that office. There was talking. There wasn't a, okay, you know, we want to talk with Lieberman and we're not willing to compromise. And they were willing to, you know, bring out a couple of their staff people to talk with the peace movement. So it felt like a really wonderful moment, and I was really glad to be part of it.
Well, thank you for that summary of the actions that you took after Senator Lieberman here in Connecticut made these remarks advocating a military strike against the nation of Iran. But I have to say that it was not that long after your meeting that he repeated some of those statements. And what's your reaction to that?
I didn't know that he repeated them. I'm actually shocked. I'm heartbroken to hear that. I'm only here for a little over a week, and so I've been busy lobbying my other Congress people. I went into the Capitol Hill and talked with a staffer from Boxer's office, who was really receptive to talking to me. So I did not know that he repeated that. That's shocking. Because I had hoped that his staff would go back and say, you know, look, they made some valid points. This is not a good time to be using this sort of rhetoric. You know, this is when we're supposed to be talking. I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, America asked Iran to help in Iraq. So I don't understand how all of these politicians have decided that it's the way to go to have this aggressive talk, we want to attack them.
Yeah.
These people haven't attacked anyone in over 200 years. 70% of the population is under the age of 30. They're children. My son is 28 years old. I saw people all over that were my son's age and younger. These people don't want war. They're very pro-American. They treated us with absolute kindness and warmth. They welcomed us. They were glad we had come. When they heard we were from America, it's like they were so happy that we were willing to come to Iran and see for ourselves. And they told me over and over, we love America. I was told personally, I love you, four or five times. I mean, that doesn't happen in my country.
Well, I would just want to read you what I'm referring to when I say that he repeated the remarks about calling for military action against Iran, referring to Joe Lieberman. And this was an Associated Press piece written by Steven Singer. It's dated June 15th, And it says, Senator Joe Lieberman repeated his warning Friday that limited military action may be needed against Iranian camps suspected of being used to train and equip terrorists who are killing coalition troops in Iraq. Speaking to reporters after an appearance at a rally supporting jet engine manufacturer Pratt & Whitney's competition for a military contract, Lieberman said U.S. diplomatic efforts are important, but military action also must be an option. Military action should be limited to halting Iranian training of terrorism, not to eliminate possible nuclear sites, though force could also stem Iran's nuclear ambitions, he said. I could go on, but this was the 15th, which I believe was Friday. So, anyway.
Well, I'm really disappointed because I was hoping that his staff would have a little more influence in talking to him, how this is not productive. I mean, that was what Ross had said in the meeting, was that that kind of talk doesn't help at all. I mean, Iran doesn't need to be threatened. We need diplomatic talking with Iran. And Iran isn't equipping Iraq to kill Americans. That's crazy. There would be no motivation for them to do that. They weren't that friendly with Iraq. They'd had a war with Iraq. There's no reason for them to be killing Americans and threatening a country that they know could completely devastate their country. They don't want a war with America. I mean, we have 9 ships off the coast, and they haven't done anything to those ships. If they really wanted a war, they would have done something aggressive, but they haven't done anything. They've not attacked another country in 200 years. And why all of a sudden is America doing these preemptive things? We're not a country that was supposed to be aggressive. We were supposed to only attack in self-defense. Mm-hmm. And nobody's attacking us. There is no threat from Iran.
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of people who are listening, and I would include myself in this. You know, I disagree strongly with a lot of the policies of the Iranian government. But I think most of the people listening would probably agree that Joe Lieberman's statement calling for a military strike on Iran is counterproductive at best.
Absolutely. It's totally counterproductive. All of this talk is counterproductive because, I mean, the regime in Iran maybe isn't the best, and we don't like them, but I don't... But that doesn't give us a right to attack that country. The people are different than the government. The people that I met in Iran saw the difference between American people and the American government. Our country, my administration, does not represent me, and neither does the Iranian government represent the Iranian people. So to attack Iran is attacking civilians. I mean, you can see what's happened in the war in Iraq, is that civilians are the ones that are dying. Over 1 million civilians at this point have died in the war in Iraq. If we start a war in Iran, civilians will die. And the civilians, the people who live there, are very pro-American. It's crazy to think of using military force to change a regime.
Well, Leslie, what are the next steps? I mean, I know you're in Washington and you're focused on different things since you got back from the peace delegation to Iran, which you've let us know a bit about. But what are your plans from here on in? Are you going to continue to focus on Joe Lieberman? I want to mention, of course, before we leave this topic, that there is a demonstration planned at Joe Lieberman's Hartford office here in Connecticut. And I have a date and time and everything else I'll let people know about. But what are your plans next, Leslie?
Well, I'm going to focus on telling people in America about Iran and showing photographs. We took a lot of photographs, and so we're putting together a slideshow. We also have some live footage. We visited a school. We visited many mosques. We talked with mullah. We went to a Jewish synagogue. We went to the Armenian church and museum where the Iranian people let the Armenians in when the Turks were persecuting them. So I want to tell people how wonderful the Iranian people are, and to show them pictures. And it's a very ancient culture. It's been around forever. I mean, I went to Persepolis, which is a UNESCO site, and it's a contemporary of Greece. It has the same kind of ruins that you would find in Greece or Egypt. I mean, it's a beautiful ancient culture, and to think of bombing that place with all these beautiful children, 70% under the age of 30, is crazy. We need to start talking to governments that we don't agree with. We have to evolve out of this idea that war is the way to solve our problems. We're beyond that at this point. We need to start talking with each other and being open. And what people need to do is actually visit Iran. It's a beautiful country. It's absolutely beautiful, and the people are so kind and so generous. So I would advocate people seeing for themselves. Don't believe our government. They lied to us about the reasons to go into Iraq, and they're lying to us now. The Iranian government is not a threat to America. I mean, look at that. They're maybe going to build a nuclear bomb in possibly 5 years. We have 10,000 nuclear weapons. How is that small country a threat to America? It's crazy.
Well, these are big issues, and you know, we've been talking about the campaign against Iran and the you know, the policy options and all these issues here. But again, I have to say the bottom line is, and I'm glad you confronted Joe Lieberman's staff on this, that his calling for military action does not it's totally unhelpful to the idea of reaching a diplomatic resolution here. Obviously, Washington and Iran both know that the United States is very capable and very willing to use military force. Having Joe Lieberman stand up and say this again and again does not help create a good atmosphere for a good environment for having a diplomatic negotiation or even initiating one. So thank you for what you did very much.
You're welcome, and thank you for informing me about his statement. I will go into his office tomorrow and ask what is going on. I'm really disappointed to hear this.
Yeah, this was Friday on June 15th. There's an Associated Press.
So the day after that we saw his staff.
The day after you saw him, right.
He didn't change at all.
Right, he was here in Connecticut, and I'm sure you changed the hearts, at least maybe the outlook of his staff people, but I guess not Joe Lieberman himself when you got to meet with his staff in the Washington office on Thursday. It didn't reach Joe Lieberman, apparently, on Friday.
Okay.
I'm sure this is something that Code Pink and groups here in Connecticut are going to be working on. I just want to mention...
Yes, we will be. We're going to be taking Joe Lieberman to task, and we're also going to be talking with the different presidential candidates, because all of them are saying different things about Iran, and it just doesn't make any sense, and it doesn't help diplomatic talks.
Well, just so the listeners and you know, there is a demonstration scheduled to occur at Joe Lieberman's Hartford office here in Connecticut at One Constitution Plaza, right downtown Hartford, this coming Wednesday, June 20th at 4 p.m. People will be gathering at the corner of Market Street and Kinsley Street.
Again, okay, I will let the Code Pink people know that.
That's Wednesday.
What time is it again?
It's Wednesday, June 20th, this Wednesday, 4 p.m. At the Constitution Plaza. That's where Joe Lieberman's Hartford office is, Constitution Plaza. And again, 4 p.m. And they're going to be gathering at Market Street in Kinsley.
Market and Kingley, okay.
Kinsley, right. All right. Well, thank you so much for what you did and bringing back your views of the Iranian people and where they stand in all this. It's a very dangerous point in our own history where we could very easily find ourselves in a new war here if the voices of Joe Lieberman are not tempered with protest and outrage by citizens who don't want to see an eager Bush administration run us into another new war. And we've been speaking tonight with Leslie Angeline of Code Pink. And Leslie, give us the web address for Code Pink.
www.codepinkalert.org.
Codepinkalert.org. Well, thank you so much again, and we'll talk again soon. Let's stay in touch.
Thank you.
All right. Take care, Leslie.
Yeah, you too.
Bye-bye.
Peace and freedom.
and Leslie Angeline. We're going to just take a quick listen to some interviews and some sounds from the march protesting the immigration raids in New Haven this past Saturday that began on Front Street right there in the river in the Fairhaven neighborhood, marched all the way to City Hall on a very kind of rainy Saturday afternoon. And we're going to just take a quick listen to some of the sounds here before we make way for the next program at 10 p.m. But let's go to this as we wind up the program this evening. Again, this is recorded this past Saturday in the protest by a whole diverse group of people marching. 500 to 1,000 people marched down Grand Street, again, from Fairhaven in the river, in the bridge there in Fairhaven, all the way to City Hall, right on the green in downtown. Here we go.
Well, what it brought me here is that I am pro-immigrants. I believe they are also human beings, and they have the rights, and what's going on is inhumane, and I don't support that. So that's why I'm here today, to support them.
And do you have any concerns about the raids that have taken place recently? Had the federal agents come down? Do you think that might have kept some people away from this march?
Yes, I think a lot of them are scared and they stay home and they're not. They should be here, but they're not because they think if they're here, something's going to happen to them. And I just don't, you know, I don't like what the government did. I think it's inhumane and they shouldn't have done it that way.
And I see you got a Local 34 button. You're involved with the union here.
Yes, I'm a Local 34. I'm a steward in, for Yale University.
That's great. Well, thanks very much. Appreciate you talking
welcome.
To me.
Okay, I'm Andrea Vandenhever, and I'm the president of the Connecticut Center for a New Economy and a leader of Unite Here.
And tell us a bit about today's march and the events that preceded it.
Well, last week on Wednesday morning, the federal government sent agents in here from ICE, Immigration Control and Enforcement. They came in with 20 warrants. They served four of them and then ended up snatching 33 people out of their homes in front of their children and in front of their husbands and wives. So there are some real serious questions about constitutional violations, and the community has just basically come together in support of these residents of our city.
As far as the timing of these ICE raids and its connection with the Board of Aldermen in New Haven's passage of the new municipal ID program, what's your view of that connection?
Well, I think that there's been a real failure at the congressional level to come up with a comprehensive immigration reform bill. And so cities like New Haven and Mayor DeStefano in particular have been forced to come up with some solutions that will give immigrant workers and others some rights here. People, you know, things like access to library and the ability to open bank accounts. And so these municipal ID cards are going to be very helpful for everyone. And it's a leadership question on my part. At least we've got one city in the United States taking some leadership on this issue. And perhaps if other cities take the same kind of leadership, we may get some pressure on the federal government and on Congress to actually bring about some real comprehensive immigration reform.
As far as the ICE raids, though, do you think that was directly related to the passage?
Absolutely. How could you? It's just too coincidental. The chief of police doesn't remember a raid like that in 28 years, and suddenly, less than 48 hours later, there it is. So, for my part, I came to this country because of the freedoms that people have, and I saw those kinds of raids happen in South Africa, and for my part, I don't think this is acceptable. It's just intolerable, and so we have to stand up against it.
What's today's march designed to accomplish? What do you hope the message that comes out from this group of people marching here in New Haven?
Well, I think this march is going to show that people are standing together in support of both the municipal ID bill, but also primarily against the terrible actions that were taken last Wednesday. It shouldn't be tolerated. And it's not just in New Haven that it's happened. It's happened in other places across the country, and that's not good for us.
As an immigrant yourself, someone who's come from this to this country from where?
South Africa.
South Africa. How do you react to, you know, many people in this country are anti-immigrant or at least anti-illegal immigrant, and they feel people who come in illegally should be prosecuted, deported, whatever. It's a fact on the ground here that, of course, people who are trying to get some legislation passed that would legalize those who here are undocumented. But what do you say to those people?
Well, what I would say is that it's hard to imagine how the American economy in today's world will exist without the work of hundreds of thousands and thousands of immigrant workers. They're working in hotels, they're changing beds, they're working at the back of restaurants, they're working as in every kind of job imaginable. And what would happen, as it is, there's already been an economic impact here in New Haven because of the raids and people too afraid to go to work. The restaurants...
Explain that, yeah.
Well, the restaurants have been short-staffed. They haven't been able to function. Some of them have even had to shut down for a day or two because of that. So there's got to be some recognition. You can't have it both ways. You can't say that this economy depends on immigrant labor and then build higher walls and criminalize the very people who you're bringing in to work. It just doesn't make any sense.
And that was some interviews recorded at the demonstration protesting the federal raids on immigrants, undocumented immigrants in New Haven, following the passage of the municipal ID program in New Haven just 2 days earlier. This was last week. The demonstration occurred right down Grand Street. March from the Fairhaven neighborhood to City Hall in New Haven was sponsored by Junta Unidad Latina en Acción, Unite Here, 1199, a lot of union presence there. And many immigrants, I'm sure, stayed away from the demonstration in the march because they feared arrest. There's a palpable fear in New Haven, as you just heard in that last interview. For more information about organizing around these issues in New Haven, you can contact Pastor Emilio Hernandez at area code 203-410-9407. We got a lot of clergy at this march as well. Again, Pastor Emilio Hernandez at 203-410-9407, all about the issues of immigration and the local ID card program in New Haven. It's 10 o'clock. This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM, WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. Invite you to stay tuned for JF. He'll be coming around the corner soon, taking you to midnight. And we're going to be back next week at 8 o'clock with another edition of Counterpoint. And don't forget, there's going to be an immigration special program 2 Mondays from tonight on July 2nd, where Denise Manzari will be filling in this spot on Counterpoint and bringing you a full discussion, in-depth discussion on immigration issues, local and national. And if you want more information about this station, go to our website, WPKN.org. We appreciate your contributions. When you feel what we have done here on these airwaves is worthy of your support, we run on your support as we depend on contributions from our listeners to pay the bills. So be generous if you can. If you want to contact myself, Scott Harris, with any feedback, you can call the station. I'll be here for a little bit tonight. 203-331-9756. 203-331-9756. That number is good for anybody here you might want to reach during the week. You can hear some of the, you can hear the entire Counterpoint program on an MP3 audio file download at this website. That's each and every week at whiterosesociety.org, whiterosesociety.org. And you can also hear edited versions of some of these interviews on our Between the Lines Radio News Magazine website. That's btlonline.org. And you can get subscribed to program summary emails, as well as interview transcripts in our podcasts. So that's how we're going to leave you tonight. And thank you for listening. Thanks for your support. Stay tuned for JF. He's coming right up.
Nesmo King, and your dial set at WPKN 89.5 FM Bridgeport, as well as WPKM 80.7 FM Montauk. And I was just on the web looking to find out what's happening with the pledge drive. And as of, I guess, this morning, they took down the former premiums. So if you didn't get them, you're lost. But you can still contribute, and we're still $40,000 behind from what I know. So you can go to the website at wpkin.org and contribute either monthly or one big lump sum. You can do it on credit card or by check or by PayPal. And if not, if you don't have a computer, you can do it by sending us a check to Spring Fundraising, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. And those of you who are expecting art is in the Buckeye State, just south of Cleveland, by about an hour, and enjoying himself. He should be back, I guess, next week, which would make it the 25th. And talking about the 25th is that... That's a telephone beeping. Anyway, there's a spay and neuter clinic provided by the Greater New Haven Cat Project in collaboration with Team Mobile Feline Unit, a project of Tate's Every Animal Matters. Will host a one-day spay and neuter clinic at a private location, again, Monday, June 25th. For more information and eligibility, call 782-CATS. And the other thing I want to let you know before I get onto some music and other things is that you will see me this Thursday, guaranteed, at the Stratford Library at 6:25. Why? Because Jim Gordon will have his play, and the meeks shall inherit. And the play starts at 7 o'clock. Doors open at 6:30. That's at the Stratford Library. Exit 32 north or southbound on I-95. Head to West Broad Street. Go east. And then make a left on Main. And it's not far. Find a parking space. Those of you who already know, hit the Rotary. Park behind there. Fun is had by all. I've known of this gentleman for 2 or 3 years. I've seen every play that he's put on there, some at the Shakespeare Theater. He's a talented actor, a wonderful playwright, and I wish him the best. And they ask for donations. You don't have to leave one or anything. A dollar or two would be nice, but they don't ask you. It starts in the Level Room, again, 7 o'clock. I was there for the first play last Thursday, and I got there about 6:35, and the place was about 75%. Full, and by a quarter of it was about 85% full. At 7 o'clock, it was 95% full. And it stayed about that way. They start promptly. Anyway, let's see if I can get this straight. I've got, as always, together again at the Bluebird Cafe, Steve Earle, Towns Van Zandt, Guy Clark.
Rejoice. But her name she gave was Caroline, the daughter of a miner, and her ways were free, and it seemed to me the sunshine walked beside her. Oh, she come from Spencer, across the hill. She said her pa had sent her, 'cause the coal was low, and soon the snow would turn the skies to winter. she said she'd come to look for work. She was not seeking favors for a dime a day and a place to stay. While she turned those hands to labor, but the times were hard, Lord, and the jobs were few. All through Tecumseh Valley, but she asked around, and a job she found. Tending bar for Gypsy Sally. Well, she saved enough to get back home when spring replaced the winter. But her dreams were denied. Her pa had died. The word come down from Spencer. Well, she took to whoring out in the streets with all the lust inside her. There was many a man returned again. Lay himself beside her. Well, they found her down beneath the stairs. It led to Gypsy Sally's. In her hand when she died was a note that cried, "Fare thee well,